listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. All right, so the game continues in Honduras. So it's 2 weeks, 3 weeks since the election? A couple of weeks.
Yeah. And this is typical in Honduras, Don. Do you remember in our last conversation I said to you that it's very unlikely that the will of the Honduran people will be respected, certainly by the local oligarchy, and in particular probably by their U.S. masters in the State Department in Washington.
Right. When the U.S.-backed candidate, when the oligarch's candidate wins, the vote count happens pretty quick. They certify him, and they're in the presidential palace eating a celebratory dinner inside of 2 minutes. When it looks like they're losing, suddenly it takes 100 years to count the votes in. Guess what? He won anyway.
Yeah. So then what are we looking at? You and I just looked up the OAS, the Organization of American States website, and it looks as though even the Organization of American States electoral observers are proposing that there be new elections because the recent elections were so vitiated by fraud. Not on the day of the actual day of the elections was a model day, but Salvador Nasralla lost the count when the Honduran Electoral Authority, the electoral tribunal there in Honduras, stopped the count, alleging technical problems. There was my information is that there was a four-hour period in which they switched hard drives across the system, and then they started producing results again maybe two days later.
Right. This is what the OAS said. They say deliberate human intrusions in the computer system, intentional elimination of digital traces, the impossibility of knowing the number of opportunities in which the system was violated. In other words, they wiped out those records, the transaction records. Pouches of votes open or lacking votes. The extreme statistical improbability with respect to participation levels within the same department, in other words, as against the exit polls, and who showed up and who didn't. Recently printed ballots and additional irregularities added to the narrow difference of votes between the two most voted candidates and made it impossible to determine with certainty the winner.
Well, and that's that they know very well who won the election. Right. It was Salvador Nasralla, the progressive candidate that won it. And they're just covering their backs.
Right.
And they don't want their right wing patrons to be cross with them. I think the key factor there was, and I'm actually quite surprised by this, was the fact that. It seems that the European Union Observer, which is led by, I think it's a woman from Italy, just refused to sign off on stuff. And right. if the European Union said, oh, well, nothing to see here, everybody move along, then the Organization of American States would have gladly done the same. But because the European Union delegation just couldn't stomach the level of corruption and fraud that was involved, and the OAS was put on the spot.
Right.
So, you know.
Hey, you know, something else. What's his name? Almagro says that what he wants, his remedy, he's picking. I have decided to designate as special representatives former presidents Jorge Quiroga and Alvaro Colom. Notice who's missing from that.
Alvaro Colom's okay, and he's very much he would be very much in sympathy with Salvador Nasralla, and of course Quiroga is a right wing. You know, I'd call him a fascist.
But who's missing? Who's missing from that? What about that guy that was elected president that was removed in a coup d'état?
Oh right,
he's still floating around. Mel Zelaya.
Yeah, but and of course they have to kind of. Dress it up in independence and impartiality, right?
Right.
So anyway, let's see what happens. And as we said last week, this is just going to drag on and on. The right wing oligarchy back with and the U.S. government backers are going to do everything they can to make sure that their boy wins. And we'll just have to see what happens. And In technical terms, in kind of administrative, strictly administrative legal terms, never mind the fraud. And the Honduran Electoral Tribunal has nominated Hernandez as president. So, and that's like, there's huge inertia involved in that.
Right.
How is that going to be turned around? There have to be new elections. You and I said this last week, and there should have the delegation's concern should have said, look, this election was completely corrupt. The count was completely corrupt. There have to be new elections. They should have said that kind of 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And now they're finally saying it.
Yeah. Well when they say in essence they're admitting that the records of the election were tampered with and essentially destroyed. So right. that means you have to do it again. It's just, there's no other way that you can't reconstruct it. The OAS even says essentially what actually happened has been tampered with and it can't be reconstructed. So there's no way to do it without a new vote.
Right. So looking at the broader regional context, what that means from the point of view of Luis Almagro, who's a kind of this odious clown running the Organization of American States on behalf of his U.S. State Department owners, and he's essentially saving the credibility of the Organization of American States,
such as it is.
Because if they hadn't come up with something along the lines of what they've said now, very late in the day. The OAS would have lost all credibility, and they
need it.
That's particularly important because they can't target Venezuela and give a gangster like Juan Orlando Hernandez a free pass. the two things just
right.
Even from a right wing point of view, they can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the only game in town anymore. That's the thing that's sort of betrayed by the role that they're forced to play now. You know, for many years, since the creation of the OAS, that was the primary multilateral organization in the hemisphere. And particularly with the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 and the rise of the multilateral project that was developed with Venezuela and the ALBA countries at the center of it in a lot of ways, you had CELAC and all these different places, and finally UNASUR, where everybody except the U.S. and Canada participate more or less, where people can take their grievances to the whole, the whole region, to the governments of the whole region, without the U.S. mediating it. And the people of those countries got used to that also. You know, once that happened, there's a whole different narrative that goes with it. And so when they have to go back to their own people, whether it's a right-wing government and even a right-wing electorate or not, they can't just go in on a fantasy that everyone knows is fake, because at UNASUR, at whatever other multilateral group the country participates in, the people there will be talking about this joke at the OAS.
Right. Yeah, and essentially, Luis Almagro is struggling to save the OAS credibility.
Right.
And I think it's worth pointing out, and this is something I feel strongly about, the role of CARICOM, the Caribbean nations, within the Organization of American States. If you look at that, if you analyze that over the last 2, 3, 4 years, and it's been very interesting the way that even kind of center-right CARICOM countries work together with the other Caribbean island nation governments. They've supported Cuba resolutely. And I think largely as a result of Venezuela's influence in the Caribbean, because it's easy to forget that Venezuela, in many ways, is a Caribbean country,
right?
Because of its geography.
Right.
It's at least as much a Caribbean country as Trinidad and Tobago or Guyana, right?
That's right.
So the CARICOM has defended Venezuela, and it's the CARICOM countries that prevented Luis Almagro getting the technical majority that he needed in the Organization of American States, some political council, for initiating much more severe sanctions from the Latin American Caribbean region against Venezuela. It was CARICOM that prevented that. And that's
right.
And they've also, as I said, been extremely resolute defending Cuba, and they recently had a conference with Cuba. Two or 3 months ago, CARICOM and Cuba had their conference, in which they agreed to maintain a common position on a series of issues and agreed to disagree on other issues. But I mean, that's so important in terms of presenting a common front against the imperialist designs of the United States government and its allies in the regional oligarchy. And something interesting that just a footnote really to what we've been talking about with regard to Honduras. And today or tomorrow, I think it is, in Cuba, the municipal councils of people's power start operating. And this is a tremendous example of the grassroots democracy that Cuba embodies. Because what you're going to have is ordinary people across the country actively participating in real decision making about what happens in their communities. Now, imagine that in Honduras in the current context. I mean, forget it. And so people need to be very aware. I'm sure most of our listeners probably are already very aware. But that's just another example of the way that genuine grassroots democracy goes set up in a revolutionary system can just completely contradict the anti-democratic, anti-humanitarian, essentially politically repressive logic of the electoral democracies of North America and Western Europe.
So then the
other big event over the weekend was the election result in the presidential runoff in Chile,
right?
Which was between, as our listeners probably already know, Alejandro Guillier, the kind of the centrist candidate, can hardly call him a progressive candidate given many of his policies, and the right-wing candidate Sebastián Piñera, who's had one term as president prior to the current term of President Michelle Bachelet. And Sebastián Piñera had a good win on a low turnout. Turnout was something like 48-49%.
Yeah.
51-52% abstention.
Right.
And as we said, you and I said last week, that and if there was a low turnout, that would favor Piñera. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And he got out of the turnout, he got about 54.58% of the vote as opposed to 45.42% apparently.
Right. So, and that's a very disappointing result from the point of view of progressive forces in Chile. But one has to remember that there's been a huge change in the legislative makeup of the Chilean Congress, because Beatriz Sánchez's Frente Amplio won a very large number of deputies compared to kind of all virtually zero representation in previous Chilean legislatures. As a result of the recent legislative elections, the Frente Amplio, which is the kind of alliance of the most progressive and radical parties in Chile, they finally got their act together after many years of disarray. And they did very well. They've been very successful in getting, and I can't remember the exact number of seats, I think it's over 20 in the Chilean legislature. And that's going to make life much more difficult in terms of, perhaps not in terms of Piñera getting his legislative agenda through Congress, although it remains to be seen what the Guillermo alliance legislators, what is going to be their attitude to the measures that Sebastián Piñera is likely to propose. And one of the reasons that Piñera did so well is that he appeared to make concessions in terms of making state education more accessible to ordinary people. But in terms of the other big, there are various major issues in Chile. One is abortion, and another is the pension fund administration system, which is hopelessly biased against the interests of the majority of people in Chile. And it's not clear to me what's likely to result in terms, because Guillermo was very resistant to change, whereas the Frente Amplio were pressing him to make a radical decision in as regards the administration of pensions in Chile. He refused to do that, and so it's likely that Piñera will be able to cobble together some kind of arrangement that maintains the current extremely unjust pension arrangements in Chile, in support of the profits of his corporate supporters. So that pension issue, that whole pension issue is very important in the region. And if you look at what's happening in Brazil, for the first time in many months, the administration of, is it Michel Temer that, or Julius Temer, Michel Temer. He suffered a major defeat in the Brazilian Congress over his proposed pension reforms. I was reading an article about that last night. and it looks as though, and this commentator who's a kind of center-left commentator was saying it would be easier to find a refrigerator at the North Pole than a political analyst that gives a snowball's hell in chance in hell of Temer passing his pension legislation, right. Which he said, Temer said, we're going to hang on to this and we'll try and vote on it in February next year.
Yeah, apparently he says that he's 2 or 3 dozen votes short of of being able to push through his proposal. And I guess he had some kind of urinary tract surgery last week also, so he used that. I'm in the hospital, we'll have to postpone the vote.
Right, yeah. So, if you put that in the broader context in Brazil and in the regional context, and in Brazil, the specific context is that Lula Ignacio da Silva is streets ahead of anybody else in terms of electoral popularity in and Brazil goes to elections in July next year. So we're something like 6 months away from the elections. Ignacio Lula da Silva is the overwhelming favorite to win those elections. But he still faces an important legal hurdle. And it remains to be seen what will happen with regard to that, because, and across the region, as you and I have mentioned on various occasions over the last year and a half, 2 years, and there's been this judicialization of politics, or maybe it's the politicization of judicial systems. It doesn't matter how you kind of describe the mechanism, but essentially the legal systems throughout the region have been exploited and manipulated by right-wing governments to attack left-wing political opponents with specific electoral objectives. And the attack against Cristina Kirchner currently going on in Argentina is a response to the fact that she got elected to the Senate in the recent legislative elections. And the right Macri's right wing government, which has become more and more repressive, as you and I said it would.
Oh yeah.
And years ago, I mean, immediately after that win, it was just so obvious.
Right away. They started right away. They started in on it. Yeah.
So then, the judicial system in Argentina is being manipulated, forget about evidence. These processes in Latin America and probably anywhere else don't need evidence. It's enough for the process to be set in motion.
Right. Same and here in the U.S., by the way. That's what they're doing in the U.S. at this point also.
Right. So they set up this judicial administrative statutory dynamic, which is specifically designed to either cripple the electoral possibilities of the target person. In the Argentina's case, it's Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. In Brazil, it's Lula Ignacio da Silva. In Ecuador, it's the possibilities of the team of former President Rafael Correa with the legal, the imprisonment, in fact, and the sentencing on spurious corruption charges of Rafael Correa's colleague Jorge Glass, who was the vice presidential candidate in recent elections. But and Ecuador's another story. We need to talk about that separately. But the pattern is absolutely clear. And so if they can't make it impossible for these candidates, left-wing candidates, progressive candidates, to stand in elections, what they try and do is smear them in such a way that they'll lose electoral support, and that's what all these judicial processes are about.
Yeah, it's not just left wing either. By the way, the U.S. has been doing this kind of game in Latin America. Certainly, its backyard since Monroe. But they've been doing this around the world in post-war Italy and across Europe really, and throughout Africa and Asia, and they've imported it back to the United States now. And they'll attack even the right-wing extremists, using the same methodology if it's not someone that's on the team. That's what we just saw with this guy Moore. I don't know whether he actually did any of the things that he was accused of, but I do know there hasn't been a bit of evidence presented, and it's widely accepted that he did these things without that evidence. And it's, you know, that's not a condition that should prevail in, you know, society that's supposed to make major decisions based on facts and information.
Right, and in the returning to Latin America, you can see that happening with the President Kuczynski in Peru.
Yeah,
he's now caught up in the Odebrecht scandal. I've been trying to puzzle that out. Why would anybody go after Kuczynski? Why would the right wing, and he's very right wing candidate. He's a business sector candidate.
Yep.
You know, he's somebody that supports all the major U.S.-sponsored free trade initiatives, neoliberal economic policies. He's all up for that.
I mean, they're going after him hard. You know, they submitted an impeachment motion against him in Congress.
Yeah. Now, if you look, well, why is that happening? And the only rational answer I can come up with that is because the local Peruvian oligarchy and its homologues across the region don't want to see Bolivia progressing. They want to keep, and because in Bolivia, Evo Morales has recently established his right to stand for re-election in the next presidential elections in Bolivia.
Right, so they're going to continue. that whole process that's been going on in Bolivia is going to continue.
Yeah, so, but who has thrown a lifeline to Bolivia in its fight to get access to the sea?
Right.
It's precisely Kuczynski.
Right.
Kuczynski has offered Bolivia a complete package of access to the sea via a port called Ilo in the south of Peru, and that is part of the Latin American extension of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, because Ilo would be the departure point for maritime shipping arriving on Peru's Pacific coast and heading down to a port on the southern Atlantic coast of Brazil.
Yeah, this is really some interesting stuff here. I mean, you're talking right now, Bolivia has to use the northern Chilean ports for commerce, and instead we're looking at a 99-year lease under Bolivia's control for a port that's with an international highway to it. So they've got direct contact to the, you know, Silk Road, Belt, and whatever project they call it when it comes this way.
Yeah, and so from Bolivia's point of view, that's, and because it still essentially depends on its exports of gas and minerals, having unfettered access to that port at Ilo in Peru.
Right.
Means that it has free, it can freely export its produce and materials, not just to China but also to India, because India's got huge investments in Bolivia. So, and as you say, it opens up a whole other perspective on what's going on in Latin America, what's going on in Asia, what's going on in terms of the United States government's ability and the U.S. corporate elite's ability to stem their inevitable decline vis-a-vis the incredibly powerful forces that are economic forces that are being unleashed by China, by the Russian Federation,
India,
and by those countries' allies across over there in Asia. And so and this brings us back to another point that you and I have touched on at different times over the last couple of years, and that is, and what is going, who, how is the argument going to pan out between within the right-wing oligarchies in Latin America? because what you have is you have these factions that are very well aware that the United States economy and the United States corporate elites are essentially a global power in decline. So what is going to be their response to that? And there's there are fierce arguments about how to manage that.
You know, you have that. That's like the macro picture. And then you have like the more immediate, like transactional aspects also, which is something we've discussed. Like, you know, the sheer force of economic activity that the project that was set in motion by Chavez and others, drew so much, gravity, basically, that even right-wing governments that were politically, inconsistent or contradictory to, say, the Venezuelan government, the Nicaraguan government, whatever, were compelled and, positively incentivized to do business with them because they made money doing it. Here, right. what if you can open up the interior of South America to China, to the commerce with China, India, and the rest of the world without having to pay the United States or corporations benefiting from the United States, whatever. In other words, remove the American monopoly and let businesses in Brazil and Peru and these other places do business with whomever they want. They like that. They make money doing that. And that is an incentive for them to say, you know what? Okay, well, we have, the global picture is changing, so here's our political cover for this. But hell, I'm going to make some more money doing this deal. Let's do it. And I think that that drives a lot of it, too.
Yeah, and I think that there's some element of that is going on, for example, in what's happening in Venezuela.
Yep.
And the right-wing business community there look at what's going on in their own country, and they see that they're up against what is essentially an immovable force.
That's right.
Which is Chavismo in Venezuela.
Right. The people.
And they've been unable to defeat Chavismo despite everything that they've tried. So what are they going to do?
Right.
Are they going to destroy their country in a civil war, or are they, as you just said, going to start making some money with China and Russia and the other Asian economy?
And Nicaragua is a perfect example of how the local business class can do well, and we'll pick it up there next week, Tony, because we're out of time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
The end of 2017, and that means it is time to review the most censored stories of the year, according to the nonpartisan group Project Censored. Of course, if our fucking mainstream media actually did their job, there would be no need for Project Censored or even for Redacted Tonight, for that matter. So I'm actually hoping my show goes off the air. I'm hoping one day I start the show, I walk out, and I'm like, CNN covered it all. They got it all. I'm sorry. Goodbye, I guess. But something tells me I got a little more job security than that. I don't have much time to get into all of enough time to get into all the 25 stories, but here are a few of the most important. Widespread lead contamination threatens children's health and could triple household water bills. We all know about Flint, Michigan's lead poisoning. The fetal death rate in Flint has gone up 58% in the past 3 years. But luckily, much of America is showing solidarity with Flint by getting our own lead poisoning. Everywhere from Cleveland to Baltimore to Philly to Texas, children are testing positive for high lead levels. The CDC estimates that 2.5% of all U.S. children under the age of 6 have elevated blood lead levels. And our regulatory agencies that are supposed to stop this type of thing don't give a shit, because they've been captured by the industries, and having a population dealing with lead poisoning is actually good for our rulers. When you and I are struggling with that kind of stuff, we aren't standing up, getting angry, protesting. You're not getting overly educated and studying ways to fight back, right? Here's how they view us normally, all right? This is how they view the population. Equal rights. Now here's you on lead. So it's good for them. The U.S. relies on an estimated 1.2 million miles of lead pipes, and much of this aging infrastructure is reaching or has exceeded its lifespan. You know, some people compare our country to the Roman Empire, and our collapse is beginning to look very similar. But at least the ancient Romans didn't stuff themselves full of lead. Oh, wait. Yes, they did. The Roman aqueducts had lead pipes, and scientists have found that tap water from ancient Rome contained up to 100 times more lead than local spring water. The only difference between us and them is elite Romans drank from the lead pipes. Nowadays, our elites don't care about our collapsing infrastructure because they are using it. They don't drink out of the tap. They would sooner stuff dog food up their nose. They don't need the tap water, the public transit, the public schools. They privatized their world, and now they're letting our world collapse while they spend every one of our tax dollars on military. Speaking of that, next up on Most Censored, over $6 trillion in unaccountable army spending, according to the Department of Defense's Office of Inspector General. Do you understand? I said trillion with a T. Do you have any idea how many not lead pipes that could buy? All of them. All of the not lead pipes. We're basically sustaining ourselves on the ass end of the military-industrial complex. We've got our lips human centipeded around their tailpipe. We're eating their lead, funding our society off their scraps. And they don't even feel any need to give us a good excuse for losing trillions of dollars. Like when you and I fill out tax forms and we're trying to get away with something, we come up with some shit to cover it up, right? We write off our butt implants as a life-saving procedure, or, you know, declare our goldfish as a dependent or something. But we come up with an excuse. But as Thomas Hedges reported for The Guardian, the Pentagon has exempted itself without consequence for 20 years now, telling the Government Accountability Office that collecting and organizing the required information for a full audit is too costly and time-consuming. That's not a fucking excuse. That's like saying we don't wanna. You know, I will grant you that $6 trillion requires a big excuse, you know, but say they're battling extraterrestrials that they haven't told us about, you know, and the extraterrestrials are allergic to Bitcoin, so they're firing Bitcoins at them, and it's $17,000 a bullet. Come up with something, you know? Next up, there was major voter suppression in the 2016 presidential election, meaning our election was not legit. Also heavily censored this year, the DNC claimed the right to select the presidential candidate and ignore what the voters want, which means our 2016 election was not legit. Also in the most censored, big data and dark money was behind the 2016 election, which means our 2016 election was not legit. If I didn't know better, I'd say the mainstream media doesn't want us to know that our election was not legit. In 2013, the Supreme Court gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. And sure enough, suppression was rampant in the 2016 election. 14 states, including many southern states and swing states, implemented new voting restrictions. Texas implemented a photo ID law that resulted in one of the lowest voter turnouts in the country. In North Carolina, over 300,000 registered voters lacked even one accepted form of ID. All three of these things, detailed by Project Censored, means our election system is a fucking joke, bigger than when you jump out from behind the refrigerator naked just to scare the shit out of your roommate, you know? And you're like, ah, ha, ha, gotcha! And then he's like, ah, and stabbed you in the heart with a fork. And then as you bleed out, you're like, oh, you should have seen your face. I'd do that all the time. All All three of these things, the DNC admitting in court they can rig the primary, the voter suppression via interstate cross-check and other techniques, the use of big data by Cambridge Analytica, owned by billionaire Robert Mercer, one of Trump's biggest donors. All of those things people say, well, why didn't I hear about it? It wasn't covered on TV. But I actually did see all three of those on one show. I think it was called Redacted Tonight, I think. But honestly, yeah, all right, easy. Those motherfuckers are clearly Russian trolls, all right? The truth has a well-known Russian troll bias. It does, so. As Project Censored pointed out, cable news devoted hours and hours to Trump's absurd claim that the election was rigged against him, while spending precious little time on the real threat that voters faced. Moving on, another story we covered on Redacted, antibiotic-resistant superbugs threaten the health and foundations of modern medicine. Pharmaceutical companies that produce antibiotics are creating dangerous superbugs when their factories leak industrial waste. Superbugs are bacteria that have become resistant to antibiotics. Pharmaceutical factories in China and India, the places that, you know, produce this, manufacture this stuff, are releasing untreated waste fluid into local soils and waters. I find that funny because untreated waste fluid is also my nickname for the corporate Democrats. So, we know they don't have a backbone or a skeletal structure of any kind. So I figure that waste fluid has a similar consistency, whereas the Republicans are kind of a standing, walking untreated waste fluids. I guess that makes them more evolved. Maybe, I don't know. Back to the superbugs. Superbugs have already killed an estimated 25,000 people across Europe, thus globally posing as big a threat as terrorism. Now, this might sound like a bad thing, but there are too many fucking people walking around this world. Have you seen the, like, escalators? You can't even, they're all jammed up. It's like trying to pass a kidney stone just to get into the subway. We need to decrease the numbers, and hoverboard accidents aren't nearly racking up the totals we were all hoping for. I mean, we'll be sitting here for all day waiting for texting while driving to handle the job. It's just not doing it. I'm just saying, does it make me a traitor if I'm rooting for the superbug? Is that, would superbug consider running for office maybe? But don't worry, Project Censored also has other ways we're successfully destroying ourselves. How about climate change? Shell Oil understood climate change as early as 1991 and ignored it. Not just understood it, but created an amateur, crappy after-school special about how bad it's going to be for us. I've shown the video on the show before, and then Shell fucking suppressed it. And I don't think the reason they shelved it was because the, you know, lighting didn't look good or there were too many jump cuts, you know, it didn't flow right. They did it because they didn't want to fuck up their profit structure. They'd rather kill humanity instead. And the same goes for every corporate news pile of dung heap, you know? And here's the last most censored story I have time for, despite the fact that our police continue to kill hundreds, if not thousands, of unarmed civilians every year. Killings by police are not inevitable or difficult to prevent. And there are 8 use of force policies to prevent killings by police that are highly effective. What? There are ways to not kill people? Rubbish, I say! Here are some of the easy changes we could make to our police forces. Require officers to de-escalate situations before resorting to force. Oh, so require them to not kill before they decide to kill? I like that. I'm a fan of that. Limit the kinds of force that can be used to respond to specific forms of resistance. Oh, so you mean behave like every other human being on the planet? If someone punches you in the face, you can't murder them. You can poke them in the eyes, you can give them a nipple twister, you can give them an atomic wedgie. There are other options. prohibit officers from shooting at moving vehicles. Oh, you mean this isn't fucking Mission Impossible and you don't have the aim of Angelina Jolie in Tomb Raider? Require officers to stop colleagues from exercising excessive force. Okay, repeat after me, police officers. Hey man, stop shooting for a second. There's a lot of paperwork if you kill that guy. That is terrible. You'll be up to your elbows in carpal tunnel. Just don't do it. So basically, there are a few simple steps that would save a lot of people's lives. And don't get me wrong. I'm still pro Superbug, all right? I just don't like out of control police. So those are only some of the most censored stories of the past year. You can get the rest at projectcensored.org. And don't just think about these stories. Think about why these stories aren't allowed on your corporate media. Yeah. Coming to you from Washington, D.C., the belly of the beast is redacted tonight.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome. I'm Lee Camp. Now let's take the news from behind. Accused pedophile Roy Moore lost his bid for the Senate in Alabama. That means other guy beat him, but just barely. Many are celebrating this as a huge win, but let me repeat, other guy barely beats an accused pedophile who was on a watch list at a local mall for stalking young girls. Do you know how fucked up you have to be to get on a watch list at a mall? You gotta look at all the bizarre people hanging out at malls all day. This guy stood out, all right? You gotta look past the kleptomaniacs, past the pyromaniacs, past the straight-up maniacs, and be like, wait, what the fuck's the matter with that guy? He's got a lollipop on his string. What the fuck is... And yes, I agree. It is better to have not a pedophile in the Senate than a pedophile. But does anyone else think maybe our standards are a little low in this country? Let me show you a chart of what's happened to us. In the 1980s, for most big elections, you'd have not bright movie actor versus dope who wanted to help workers. Then that went downhill to corrupt businessman versus corrupt businessman who said yes to solar panels. Then that moved to corrupt idiot millionaire versus corrupt millionaire still with solar panels. Then we got to corrupt billionaire racist sexual predator versus corrupt millionaire racist but not a sexual predator. And now we're at corrupt racist anti-Semite pedophile versus anything else. And what the corporate media won't tell you is choosing between those two things is not freedom. That's not a democracy. We've replaced democracy with just trying to stop racist pedophiles. That's not an election. That's like a rent-a-cop's job at an arcade on a bad night. Well, one good thing you can say about racist pedophiles, at least the black kids are safe. Speaking of small victories, South Carolina police officer Michael Slager has been sentenced to 20 years for killing Walter Scott. Yeah. He shot him several times in the back as he ran away, and there was video of it. There's video of it. And yet the state murder trial still ended in a hung jury. At that point, I was like, what more do you fucking need? This would be like if you stole some teenage girl's iPhone and you were sitting there like it was yours and the name Madison is bedazzled across the thing and it's filled with photos of Madison and her friends, and you were like, this is my iPhone. And a jury was like, maybe it's his iPhone. But the reason Slager is still serving jail time is despite getting a hung jury on the murder charge, he pleaded guilty to the federal crime of violating Scott's civil rights. Yeah, I think killing the guy counts as violating his civil rights, to put it mildly. To me, that sounds like kidnapping someone for 10 years and then only getting convicted of violating their right to vote. Yeah, they weren't voting much from your basement. Anyway, at least Slager is serving some time, whereas other societal parasites are not. The CEO of Dollar General, for example, he accidentally revealed how fucked up our economy is this week. As you probably know, Dollar General, it specializes in very cheap stuff, and they do well when lots of Americans are barely making ends meet by eating off-brand foods like Crusted Flakes and Hot Fuckets. In my 20s, I lived off Hot Fuckets. So Dollar General is doing quite well right now, and the CEO said, the economy is continuing to create more of our core customer. Yay! I gotta tell you, when I roll out of my bed with its 9 billion thread count sheets made from the virginal nose hair of macaque monkeys bred inside a sterilized geodesic dome, and my eyes flutter open each morning after heaven-like sleep, I thank my lucky stars that our economy is still pumping out gut-wrenchingly poor people living in makeshift tents who will buy my contaminated, contagious products, which all smell like toxic hairspray for some unknown reason. Thank you so much, unfettered capitalism. It's a pleasure doing business with you. And we wonder why half of America has lead poisoning. Ancient Rome's aqueducts are our Dollar Generals. We have to go to a quick break, but I have live shows coming up in Portland, Oregon, Salt Lake City, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., and others. Go to redactedtour.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We now turn to scandals in Congress. Not the creeps on Capitol Hill, but your representatives in your state Congress. Your friendly neighborhood crooks. A new study found that many state representatives are voting for laws which benefit their own businesses. Color me shocked. But I always thought screwing should happen more locally. You know, you waste less on gasoline that way. Here to discuss is our senior corrupt expert, Naomi Garibaldi. Naomi.
Lee, you're not looking at the bright side. State politicians have jobs. You wouldn't want them idle, roaming the streets at night. They might get into crime, or worse, join an a cappella group. In 40 states, the job of voting for your dumb highways isn't even full-time, so 76% of state reps have outside incomes. Most of them are lawyers and very busy and very miserable, so we're lucky. We're lucky they're volunteering to corrupt our state politics. I mean,
it's very nice of them. But the idea is that lawmakers serve their constituency, right? Not their ice cream franchise.
Lee, you can't avoid conflicts of interest. They're everywhere. In Pennsylvania, a lawmaker voted for his own mother's nomination for a public office.
His own mother.
Well, imagine if he didn't vote for her. As the holidays approach, no stocking stuffer would fill that mother's broken heart. See, the state writes their own ethics rules, and it's up to lawmakers to recuse themselves from proceedings if they have a dog in the race.
I think it's horse in the race.
Dogs can horse, too.
What? So why didn't that guy recuse himself?
No assembly takes recusal seriously if they have a horse in the fight.
I think it's dog and... Never mind.
Plus, if you wrote the bill, you can't skip the vote. Louisiana State Rep. Paul Hollis, who moonlights dealing rare coins, sponsored a sales tax break for rare coins. But who else would care enough to vote on that? Who would show up? It's not a conflict of interest. It's a conflict of uninteresting.
Okay. It's hard to trust a man who's swimming in coins like fucking Scrooge McDuck.
Well, at least he didn't hide it. Hollis even sold coins on television.
Coins to me serve as a relic of history, a time capsule. And it doesn't matter if they're a $500 coin, a $50,000 coin, or they could even be a $5 coin. To me, it encapsulates history, and that's what I love.
Don't miss the 24-hour Coin Vault Marathon, May 15th on Shop at Home.
24 hours? These officials are literally selling the things they're legislating on live television?
Oh, come on. There's worse side gigs than pushing mid-century Apache nickels. To lure clients with drunk driving charges, Senator Stephen Archambault used his Rhode Island state legislature experience on his law office website. It reads, Archambault literally wrote this law, and he knows exactly what to do to succeed for you. So he definitely had a snake on the plane. You
know? These laws are basically written to fill the pockets of the authors.
Well, but that's not the best-selling author. Nevada's state senator Kieckhefer helped write and approve a $750 million tax increase for the new Raiders stadium in Las Vegas. Now, I thought he was just a hardcore Raiders fan, but turns out he had a cat in the hat. His side hustle is client relations for a major firm whose clients included the Oakland Raiders.
Seriously? Well, all right, you've got to be pissed off about that one.
Lee, I really shouldn't comment. I'm a Raiders fan, so I have a squirrel in my bonnet.
Naomi Garibaldi, everyone! Moving on, there's a crisis in Honduras right now, and our reaction has been very telling. There's also a lot going on in Venezuela, and our reaction has been very telling. To break this down, let's go to redacted correspondent Jonah O'Donnell.
Honduras versus Venezuela. Much like my mom's view of my younger brother Michael compared to me, the U.S. seems to have a more favorable take on one than the other. Last year for his birthday, she got him a new laptop. She got me a box of pencils. Fair enough, he helps out a lot around the house, you know, and I may have puked on the Thanksgiving dinner table. But still, I think it's clear what I'm saying. Our U.S. foreign policy is arbitrary and capricious. The U.S. State Department has certified that the Honduran government has been fighting corruption and supporting human rights, clearing the way for Honduras to receive millions of dollars in U.S. aid. The only problem is the Honduran government is partaking in corruption with the attempted theft of the most recent presidential election on November 26th, which took place just 2 days before the latest U.S. aid package was signed off on. 2 days? Come on, Rex Tillerson. Couldn't you at least pretend Honduras is in a Klein state a little bit? Like, Mom, couldn't you at least pretend Michael isn't clearly your favorite son? That tattoo is bullshit! Also bullshit.
The president of Honduras is deploying U.S.-trained forces against election protesters.
Yeah, cut to Venezuela. Back in August, the Trump administration issued a sanctions order prohibiting Americans from dealings in new debt and equity issued by the Venezuelan government and by its state oil company, PDVSA. And according to U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster,
as you've seen, the president signed a new executive order that strongly punishes the Venezuelan regime. This order demonstrates more clearly than ever that the United States will not allow an illegitimate dictatorship to take hold in the Western Hemisphere.
Nope, no illegitimate dictatorships taking hold, only legitimate dictatorships, like the ones we support in, say, Saudi Arabia or the Philippines. In all fairness, Venezuela was sanctioned because President Nicolas Maduro convened a special assembly to rewrite the Constitution. But the president of Honduras essentially did the same thing in 2015. The Honduran Supreme Court has struck down an article of the Constitution that prohibited a sitting or former president from seeking a second term. The move had vigorous backing from President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who will now be allowed to run for re-election. Yeah, President Juan Orlando Hernandez manipulated the court so he'd even be allowed to run again for president. Just like my brother manipulated our mom into thinking I sold all of her good candles to buy DMT. Oh, who cares if it's true? Hernandez's manipulation of the court is eerily similar to the scenario that led to the 2009 U.S.-backed coup in Honduras when then-democratically elected president Manuel Zelaya just wanted to hold a referendum seeing if there was interest in him running for a second term. Hey, former President Zelaya, what do you think of the relationship between Honduras and the U.S.?
The Honduran institutions have been co-opted from the coup d'etat to date. There's no democracy here. There's no rule of law here. We are suffering repression here. People are being persecuted. There are human rights violations every day. There's no due process. There's nothing. Since the coup d'etat, the United States has done what it wants with this country. They changed all the laws. This is a military state.
Whoa, a military state. You'd think that would be something the U.S. would be all about sanctioning, except for the fact that we're propping it up. We're hypocrites, man. We've been doing this forever. Like back in 73, we created a coup to take out the democratically elected socialist president of Chile, Salvador Allende. And we've tried like 900 times to assassinate Fidel Castro. Yet we love President Duterte in the Philippines, even as he commits mass murder against his own people. We support Saudi Arabia, even as they've created a genocide in Yemen. But we destroyed Libya, even though Gaddafi gave every one of his people a free house and an education. Not a great guy for other reasons, but still, you get my point. Look, is Venezuela a perfect society? Far from it. Inflation is out of control, there's been internal mismanagement, and far too much of a reliance on oil for their economy. But as a struggling country, do they deserve to be further squeezed by the most powerful nation on Earth just because we want their oil on our terms? Of course not. Meanwhile, you have Honduras rigging elections and slipping closer and closer toward a dictatorship. And meanwhile, you have my brother angling to get the entire inheritance. I'll be goddamned if one of those porcelain baby seals doesn't go to me. Hey, Mom, remember that time I drove all the way to Chester, New Jersey just to get you that good ice cream? Yeah? Porcelain baby seal, huh? Reporting from Washington, John F. O'Donnell. Redacted tonight.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.